Hi, welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. And in case you aren't familiar with it yet, this is a show where I have conversations, kind of in-depth interviews with people, professionals, really, in a wide variety of fields, generally around my professional interests, so in marketing, branding, advertising, communications, but it's pretty varied, media, innovation. I'm also really into tabletop games and gaming in general, so I like to talk about the inspiration from game designers and all of these conversations. By the way, they're great if you're professionals in this area, but it's not meant to be only reserved to people that are professionals in these areas. It's really having conversations to find out who these people are, where they're from, what their inspirations are, how do you get into these kinds of jobs, what they entail, and what's involved in them, essentially. And the rest of the time, I'm a marketing and brand strategist. So in other words, I generally work with different brands, clients, communication agencies, advertising agencies, and work with them to help them understand how best to communicate with their audiences and better understand how people perceive these brands. And, how should you take a particular brand or communication problem and solve it, essentially. So, and that's something that we talk about in this particular episode. I'll come back to that. It's kind of late. I mentioned in the last episode last week, I was on holidays in the south of France. I'm back in London now, which was a fantastic time spent with friends and family for my father's 70th birthday, but also the kind of holiday that you kind of need another holiday to recover from it. The weather wasn't great. I mean, even though it's a convenient excuse, but I mean, even if the weather was great, we probably would have still been drinking and partying and catching up with all friends and family as much as I did. But it also makes it, I have a bunch of work. And so now I'm finding myself recording this introduction, kind of winging it a little bit and doing it late at night because I have also a bunch of work to catch up on during the daytime. Anyhow, not to be moaning about this too much, by the way, I really enjoy everything I'm doing. And we have a very, very exciting episode today. So that's really good stuff. Don't forget, I would like to remind you this particular point. If you're a regular listener, even if it's the first time you listen, it'd be awesome if you enjoy this episode or if you enjoy the show in general to give the show a rating or review in iTunes. So iTunes or the iPhone podcast app, the main podcast app. If you like, go and look into Ice Cream for Everyone, you can probably leave a rating or review, give us a few stars. Tell us how much you like the show or what you think is good or not about it. That'd be great. You can also find the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter. So, you can hear me out and hear me interviewing and finding out about other people. But if you want to find out more about me, then the best place to find out more about me is either on my website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. And I write about myself and different stories in a weekly long-form newsletter that I call Ice Cream Sunday. And you can sign up on the website to get it in your email every Sunday. And I highly recommend you do that. I publish them with a delay online, like generally a week, but depends, if I'm on time or not. But you can find examples of that on my main blog and or on Medium, LinkedIn, or wherever you want to look it up. Now, who do we have today? We have a very exciting episode. I was at a session of Creative Mornings a few months ago with this person that I hadn't heard about called Kwame Ferrara talking. And Kwame has a company, a service design and innovation company called Kwame Corp, conveniently named after him. And he talked about that and where the name comes from a little bit. He used to work at Fjord. He used to work in a lot of different places. Quite international, fascinating person. And he was talking at the Creative Mornings in London, and I thought he was absolutely interesting. One of the main things his company is known for, at least that they talked about in his intro, is the fact that they designed or are in the process of designing the operating system for a phone called Fairphone. And Fairphone is a Dutch company. He talks about that in the show, who are designing a smartphone with only ethically, as many ethically sourced, fair sourced material and components as possible, which is quite a daunting task, as you can imagine. There's a lot of different materials and components inside of a inside of a mobile phone. And they do a lot of different things. They work with large companies like Google and Roche Pharmaceuticals and Samsung to help them solve service and innovation and technology problems. And he talks about that further in the show. Just a few points and notes. I mean, it's a fascinating conversation. I thought Kwame is quite philosophical. I met him at his studio, which is a beautiful space, but it's quite large and open. So there's a bit of background noise. I apologize for that. I still need to upgrade some of my audio equipment to try and alleviate these kind of situations when I'm recording live, which, as he said himself, is always nicer when it's possible to record live in person in London or wherever I happen to be, but sometimes not always possible. Anyhow, a couple of other things. I'm sorting out the different volumes. Kwame's a bit soft-spoken, I say, quite thoughtful, soft-spoken. And so bear with it. It starts a little bit slowly, I think, as in bear with it. If ever there's any issues in sound compared to my voice, his voice, I would imagine it might be the case if ever you're wandering around with a lot of noise around you or in traffic. But maybe not. I could be wrong. It's always a little bit difficult to evaluate how these files come out. But in any case, I know it's entirely audible. There's no particular problem with the file. But it's just, anyway, we have a lot of different conversations. Anything from the theory of the evolution canyon, which I also heard about in an episode of Radiolab recently, to what's going on in technology, the latest trends like blockchain, a little bits and pieces about artificial intelligence as a buzzword and what's really behind those kind of algorithms, where he grew up in Portugal, where he was born in Angola, the kind of nonprofit projects that his company get up to, and the people he collaborates with. Altogether, really fascinating conversation, and I really hope you enjoyed as much as I did, essentially. Without further ado, here's Kwame. Hi, Kwame. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for making time. I really appreciate it. You have a beautiful studio just around close to London Bridge in London. It's really beautiful space.
It is. Most people say it looks like a Mexican restaurant, which it does. And we haven't changed that. So we're keeping it as a Mexican restaurant with a huge...
So there's like some mosaic that are quite colorful. Was that already there then?
Or? That's the kitchen. And it's a mosaic artist, a British artist that put it together. This used to be the studio of an artist called Andrew Logan.
Okay, cool. I was looking around. So I met you very briefly after a talk you did for Creative Mornings last month in London. And it was interesting to, hear you say that generally you didn't have much of yourself going on online, that if I were to look up, I would essentially find that you recently had a child with a top model.
Yeah.
Which is true. That's the main information I found.
That is
accurate. But I managed to see on the Kwame Corp Twitter feed that, were you at a company gathering recently?
We had a company gathering, a couple weekends ago where people flew in from San Francisco and a little bit all over the world. We gathered in this convent in near Lisbon.
Oh, wow. It looks really nice. So the company gathering is something that happens, is it a yearly event or?
It happens twice yearly. I wanted everybody to cross dress, but that didn't happen. So we went with robes. Everybody had to kind of take a crazy robe. Company gatherings are very important. If you want to have a religion, you need two things. You need a place of worship and a calendar. And so corporation, and we mock the term corporation. Kwame Corporation is a bit of a take on the word. If we are to have a proper corporate culture, we need that calendar, right? So we need these places of worship. So we chose a convent.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the idea behind it.
Interesting. All right, cool. So we'll track back to a little bit more information about the business and everything else. But just going back to the beginning, where are you from? Like, where did it, your life start, I guess.
I was born in Angola. My parents were out there shooting a documentary about the cultural idiosyncrasies of a nation that was completely destroyed by war. Mm. It had just recently come out of a war with a Portuguese colony. My biological father is Brazilian. My mother is Portuguese. So we kind of ended up there. And then we moved to Brazil. My brother was born in Brazil.
Where were you living in Brazil?
In Rio.
Okay.
Yeah, my father is Carioca, is from Rio. And then we moved around a lot, but I ended up in the south of Portugal, in the mountains, with my mother and my father, who came to be a German, pedagogue, who turned into a construction mogul.
Okay.
And off the back of it, my education wasn't really very Latin. It was a bit more Germanic.
All right. Yeah. So both of your parents were filmmakers when they were born, or was that a special one-off kind of project they were doing in Angola?
I think it was a one-off kind of project. My father was a filmmaker and continues to be a filmmaker. Documentaries about, I don't know, finding monkeys in the middle of the Amazon, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
I think my mother was there to help, and to bring some sort of balance to the equation.
Okay. Interesting. And, so you moved around quite a lot. Did you have a favorite place or house or when you were growing up?
I think my favorite place is really where we ended up, and it's where I call home. Mm-hmm. It's in the south of Portugal.
Yeah.
It is a very special place because it's really the corner of Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of people from Northern Europe who in the late 70s, early 80s started walking west.
Right.
And that was as far as they could go.
Yeah.
Most of them, or a lot of them, it happened to my father. He didn't, my German father, he didn't, his hair was too long, so there's no way they would let him into Morocco. So they ended up in this weird mountainous range in the southwest of Portugal, which is quite secluded and quite unique. I mean, you have a whole bunch of French people who bought a piece of land out there and live like native Americans.
Oh, really?
Literally, like in teepees.
No, seriously? Is that from, like, what, the 70s? Or?
That's from the early 80s.
Yeah. Early 80s.
So, yeah, I don't know. There was an energy crisis, and people were quite peace and unhappy with the way cities were growing. They felt quite disenfranchised. They felt like their dreams weren't really going to be fulfilled in Megalopolis. And so they just moved back there.
Yeah. And was your upbringing a little bit kind of like that, or out of school? No. Did you go to normal school or?
No, I went, I think our upbringing,
for example,
was quite normal. I went to normal school. I loved it.
Okay.
Great teachers. There was nothing.
Yeah, you were not in teepees.
We were definitely not in teepees, but because it was part of our reality, it influenced us a lot.
Yeah.
And especially me, you know, a bunch of outcasts. It's not that we were living in a perpetual Burning Man scenario.
Right.
But there was definitely a lot of that ethos of a gift economy of people who were really looking. There was this guy, we learned to play ping pong with him. He was a vice European champion of ping pong. Turns out he was a great programmer and Swiss guy. But yes, he had a burnout and he just went out into the mountains like most other people I know. And he just bought a horse. And it just hung out with a horse and I didn't even know where he slept. And it's that type of dystopia I was always very drawn to.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so did that inform the kind of studies you went for later, or like what did you study coming into high school, university, or the one where you can choose?
I thought I was going to be a genetic engineer. I thought I'd like, because you get to manipulate DNA in real life, right?
So you're already interested in the scientific biology.
From a very early age, the mechanics of this planet, right?
Yeah.
But I moved to arts. As a teenager, when you're a teenager, your hormone balance kind of shifts slightly, so you lose the ability to have some empathy for others, and so I think I lost that for a couple of years, and I just went into a world of my own.
Yeah.
Which made it very easy for me to go into arts, right? So where I really focused on was really art, and eventually, from fine art, I went in order to go back into a more mechanical vision of the planet. I think I bridged it with design, right? Mm. So that's design. You're literally working for industry, right?
Yeah,
and on behalf of it. So that's.
What was your? Did you have a main expression, like either drawing or painting or something else?
I'm not a millennial for sure not, but I'm definitely that. I'm one of those that started going to school. There was no such thing as internet, and then the internet kind of shows up. And my father bought me a laptop very early on. Like a laptop must have cost a fortune. And so I had a laptop. I had Spectrum. So there was something about digital that was growing in parallel as we were growing. So it made perfect sense that we, as artists or entrepreneurs, as thinkers and thinkers, started to look at technology as a tool, as a world in its own right. So I went from just thinking about myself very much as an artist to having to start to think about others through digital media.
Yeah.
Because you want interaction and suddenly there are new paradigms that open up. And that digital interaction went, you know, at first it was one-to-one. Oh, check out this that I've done. Oh yeah, that's quite nice. And then it becomes one-to-two or one-to-many, right? If you do a website, ooh, look, we have all these people. To the point where you then inevitably go into political sciences and into the ability that we have to manipulate and empower. And I don't mean manipulate in a facetious way at all. But you do have that power, right? You have the power to manipulate and empower. And that has always fascinated me. So I think now what really drives me is that ambivalence, is that space that is dictated by how technology is changing our behavior.
Yeah.
You know, to the point where you have in the 70s, you look at most movies, everybody was smoking, right?
Yeah.
And eventually people found out that smoking was really hazardous and it's really bad for you. Now you hardly see people smoking in closed doors. I have very little doubts that the same will happen with the phone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the phone starts off, you know, everybody with the phone, it's amazing. And then people start, God, there's a generation of kids here that doesn't know how to socialize. And eventually it will become hazardous. It's almost like, because it isn't. It is a machine to control you as much as it is a machine to control, for you to control your reality and others, right?
Yeah.
And I think that double-edged sword is, I find that very fascinating with technology that you can.
It is very interesting. Absolutely. I remember I was listening to an episode of another podcast called Invisibilia about our relationship with our computers and our technology and they were talking about this guy who had created a wearable computer as early as it was the 90s. I think it was 97 or 98 or something like that. So he was carrying like a 5 kilo rig, essentially, that was analyzing information and with like a wearable piece on his eyes and everything else. But they were talking about the fact that, yeah, just as you were saying, we have all this information in our hands, but we also have a hand that's blocked all the time because we're not looking at the world around us. And there's going to be, I mean, presumably the next evolution is going to be like pulling whatever this phone is doing in so that we can still use both our hands.
So yeah, I run a few, I invite people, and the space we are right now is the kitchen, right? Mm. And so we have, for us, it's really important to cook together and to spend quality time together. And that means discussing the issues of the world, our woes, the fact that we fall in and out of love. And, this is, and coming from a Latino country, you know, it's really very, the relationship we have with people is paramount. Even though we do technology for the Googles and the Samsung. But we run loads of interviews over here, and the interviews that we run, we call them interviews from the future.
Okay.
And the idea is, if I was to interview you about the future, I wouldn't ask you what future do you think we're going to have, because then you would have all these assumptions. And okay, now mobile phones are going to be a lot smaller, and we might, you know, the car will drive itself. Of course, it will drive itself, and the house prices will kind of go down inside cities because you can live outside much more comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
We do ask, what I'm more interested in is, what kind of future do you want?
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of people have a hard time answering that because they say, what do you mean? What do I want? And it's what technology has done, and this whole technocratic cloud is disempowered us to believe that we actually have a say in that future. And that is something that, you know, going back to my upbringing, mm-hmm. of all these outcasts, you know, in the middle of nowhere, in the mountains, living like Native Americans, they were effectively saying, you know what, I will live however I want to live, and I will dictate the rules, and I'm in complete control, because so far I haven't been, and I'd really like to try that. And it's this, with technology, there's this relationship with the future.
Yeah.
What kind of future do we want? And technology, for most people, kind of, it's very much candy. You know, it's like, oh, it's bigger screen and it's faster memory. And it very seldomly does technology ask you what technology do you want.
Mm.
You know, it just says, oh, the technology you will have, or the future you will have, is a better version of what you're holding right now.
Mm.
And if you're not able to pivot in life, you're going over, you're not master and commander of your destiny.
But then isn't it the same relationship with everything as well as technology? Like being able to believe that, or I mean, I don't know if it's an ability, but able to believe that you can, that you're master and commander of your own ship and your own life, and able to achieve a certain amount of goals that you would have to be setting, rather than accepting a certain routine and just going in. Is it about, because it's more about, it could be about more than technology in that case.
Yeah, but technology is such a big part of, you know, the Western way of operating.
Yeah.
That I, you know, from take, the environment, take democracy, education, every single major area that touches our lives on a daily basis is completely, has been completely permeated and enabled by technology. And yet, for example, if you look at the way that you were talking about now, the UK potentially leaving the EU, if you you look at the EU and Brussels and how they operate, there's very little transparency there. You know, I'm sure they have computers. I'm sure they are highly connected. Sure. You know, everything has been technologically enabled. But it's still being run by humans at the end of the day. And those humans kind of decide, okay, no, let's keep a wall over here. Let's open up over here. And it'd be nice. It would be nice if there were more humans involved in actually saying what future do we want, what type of technology do we want, and how does it behave?
Yeah. Do you think it's kind of going opposite to the old phrase from Ford about, like, if I asked what people wanted, they would have said a faster horse? Or is it giving them the tool to empower them into looking into what they want as well?
Yeah, if I was to ask what people want, that they want a faster horse. Yes, that's very much true for most people. Because they just don't have the imagination to think about something completely different. So I do think you do need those moments where you have to get out of that energy canyon. You know, in evolution, there was an energy canyon early on, but you know, every cell kind of pretty much looked the same, and then one cell got into it.
So I don't know the term energy canyon. What's the
energy canyon? Refers to whenever there's a leap in evolution.
Okay.
It is because we were able to master energy in a much more efficient way. So in the beginning, we're all little cells, and a cell jumped on inside another and started reproducing. And then you had the mitochondria, and suddenly that relationship allowed for the energetic reality of that cell to be much more efficient. A few hundred thousand years ago, a few thousand years ago, we started mastering fire, right?
Yeah.
And that meant we got more energy out of our food.
Right.
And that also meant that because we got more energy out of our food, we had to hunt less. And so we had more time to invent stuff. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
And then with the industrial revolution, it's kind of the same thing, right? Suddenly we got, oh, let's take energy from the ground and burn it. Wow. We can move with it. Like, it makes us move faster. And so we have a lot more time to think about stuff. Right?
Got it.
Yeah, and then we thought about mobile phone.
Yes.
You know, like, so, there's always, we're always in a bit of an energy canyon. You see, until something comes along and starts to save us time. So I'm very curious to see how we can get out of this energy canyon, because in order to get where we are, the canyon, or getting out of the previous canyon using fossil fuels, is potentially going to kill us a lot sooner than we would like it to. So suddenly, you know, that solution needs to be revised. It's like, that perhaps it wasn't such a good idea. But we still need energy, right? Because we're not going to go back hunting. So there is something about the energy canyon. And there are loads of authors, I'm sure you can Google about it. I find that theory quite interesting.
Very interesting. So tracking back to where were we at in your teenagehood. So did you have any major influences? Like what kind of posters did you have on your walls as a teen? Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan fan.
Yeah.
I played a lot of basketball. Windsurfed a lot. No, I don't think I was a very social kid.
Oh yeah. Many friends or?
No, I had friends. But I was just so focused on absorbing data and information and understanding how the world worked.
Yeah.
So most of my friends were a lot older, because I could kind of, if you have something to teach me, great. If you don't, I'm not really interested.
Right, know? Okay.
So it was, the competition wasn't so much one with my classmates, but more one with my teachers.
Interesting.
Right? It's like, oh, that was interesting. Teach me something more, right?
Yeah.
because you can learn a lot from your classmates, for sure. Social skills, debating, negotiating, the performance of everyday self. Right? But that comes, I think it comes with a lot of energy costs. And I just saw, I'm going to invest my energy in a different type of relationship that usually revolved around teaching me something and I would like to.
Yeah. Cool. Good. And did you have, and then like after, what was the beginning of your career like, or work-wise or job or anything like it? So you were already computer programming and really interested in technology while you were studying, or programming, or not necessarily? I don't know.
Yeah, a little bit of both. But at that time, for me, it was mostly, it wasn't low-level programming for sure.
What's low-level
programming? Low-level programming meaning using C and Java. I was at a very scripting level, you know, like very high up and mostly worried about the appearance of things, right? Okay. And how they moved in the canvas and if people click here, that happens rather than with the infrastructure and the architecture and the data modeling behind it. That came a lot later. I think the beginning, I don't know, I had so many odd jobs here and there. But I think the beginning was I came to the UK and I came down to London and I said I could have continued with academia and doing more stuff. And I just decided what I really want to do is understand a little bit more about the mechanics of corporations and how does a city work, and especially this city over here, which, you know, financial institutions, how can they operate in with just mostly imaginary stuff and make more imaginary stuff? I mean, they must have a surplus of imagination. So I went down, I came down to London and I met a few guys who had an agency called Fjord. They kind of took me under their wing. I was very dreamy. And from that moment onwards, I started my initiation into agencies and corporations and what is a corporation? What's an agency? You know, what's its purpose? An agency
for Fjord is a design agency, right?
Fjord is a design agency that was sold, a couple of years ago to Accenture.
That's right. And so what kind of stuff did you design for anybody? Because there's people who might not know who are listening to this.
Yeah. So Fjord is a design agency. We worked with Nokia at the time, Orange, a lot of telco stuff, the BBC. So mostly big corporations, right? And we solved, service design problems. Right?
Okay.
So if you look at, so for example, the BBC would have a problem with their search, you know, how to do, Google does search incredibly well. Is there an alternative? Is there more of a visual search? And the BBC has this immense archive. Is there a way to surface that archive in a much more engaging way?
Hmm.
So problems like that.
Right.
And what I learned is that as an agency, you are a problem solver. You're a group of people who come together and get paid to solve problems.
Yes.
Right. And I guess that's what I really loved about it.
Mm.
That we were able to add value to these corporations. And by default, the people within this corporation. What I didn't like so much about it is that as a design agency, you specialize in design, right? So you come up with ideas. There's a lot of strategic thinking. And you got the requirements, you go into concepting, perhaps a little bit of prototyping, but usually not really. And then you pass it on to developers, right? And your job has been done. And I just thought that wasn't really the way I wanted to do things. What I want to do is I want to go end to end. So I want to go from idea to product, because I think the value really lies in being able to validate an idea. Everybody has ideas.
Yes.
But can you create a small prototype? Do you have the courage to go out there and ask people whether that idea, whether that prototype, would add value to their lives? And they will give you very candid answers. You know, the replies, the interaction you're going to get out of it is invaluable, and that needs to feed back into the idea, and you're going to reshape that idea slightly, and then you go prototype, and then you're going to go back into the audience to test it. And I really liked this iterative model. I didn't invent it. It comes from an agile way of doing things. Mm-hmm. It really comes from Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And it comes from a different type, a more pragmatic mindset. And it's a mindset that, funnily enough, it sounds ironic, but that removes the ego. It removes the artist. I know, I have an idea. It's the best idea ever. Great. Prove it. Right. And I think what Silicon Valley was always very good at is it had these kids who were very passionate in garages and doing their things and validating it very quickly with the market. Right.
Yes.
And once they had a little bit of traction, a whole bunch of people with a lot of vision backing them up. Right. And then they were back to the drawing board, and they're constantly breaking their product and reiterating and moving it forward. I love that.
Yeah.
And that hacker culture, really resonated with me. And so I put together, after I left, Fjord, I was in property. I was part of this, the vinyl factory group. I was doing vinyl.
And still doing a lot of artwork? Is it the same time on the side or projects?
On the side. Yeah. I think I've always done it. Mm-hmm. And will continue to do it, mm-hmm. doing it. But I think I was a bit, unfulfilled with digital. So I went into vinyl, which is as far away from digital as you can get. And then, you know, vinyl came with all its complications. And vinyl, just like books, was becoming a bit of a luxury commodity. So it's the whole secret behind it is how do you reinvent it as a luxury product?
Yeah.
So that was what we had to do. And I had already been very into the music industry, mm-hmm. because a few years earlier I had founded a record label in Portugal that then my brother took over, which became increasingly very popular.
Do you specialize in any kind of genre music?
Yeah, electronic dance music. They specialized in going to weird places in this planet, mostly Africa, and in the shanty towns of cities like Luanda in Angola, you have people who've assimilated Detroit beats and kuduro, which is a dance genre that's endemic to that area. And they created new sounds, and those new sounds were then exported through our record label. So I had been in the music. I had always been kind of in the music industry. And after digital, I went back into the music industry, and then I came out of it and put together this group of people, which is us right now. And this is where you're sitting.
So how long ago was that?
5 years ago.
Okay.
Cool. Not very long. This is who we are right now. We're a little bit more pragmatic. We're a pod of mammals at the end of the day, right? We are mammals, and we come together as a bit of a tribe, without all the kind of tribal connotations. There's a lot of warfare in tribe, and so we've moved on from there. And we solve problems. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And some people pay us to solve their problems. Other people.
So mostly working with big technology companies, or not only, do they tend to be technology problems, or not necessarily? They could be product questions or market questions, or Because I'm always curious, Lane, because I do similar brand problem solving for brands and digital. But now that I'm working for myself, I'm like, how do I go and meet people who have problems? And how do I define that? Sometimes it could be so vast, right?
Yeah, that is very true. We don't really deal with brands.
Okay.
We don't do branding. The reason why we don't do branding is because we believe that amazing branding comes from amazing experiences. So we'd rather focus on the experiences. And then if you have to kind of massage the brand, I'm sure there are better people than us to do that. Mm. But then that becomes more of a communication problem. I think we are more interested in interaction problems. There are so many problems to solve.
Is there an example you can talk about or?
We work with a company called Roche Diagnosis. So Roche Pharmaceuticals and Diagnosis, they were one of the biggest pharmaceuticals in the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they acquired a few startups out in the valley. And we worked with one in particular, helping them solve the problem of how do you diagnose cancer, but how do you look at a patient's history and get a sense for what that patient is, where they are in the whole treatment process, in just a few seconds rather than a few minutes, right?
Okay.
And that's a true interaction problem, right? So there are loads of data sources that we need to take into account. Patient's history, new drugs, all sorts of things. So that is an example of a problem that we help solve. We help solve problems with Google, for example, with Samsung, on their services side, and a lot of what you see on a Galaxy phone. And it's solving problems with our customers, not for our customers. Right? Right. That's a big difference. You don't kind of throw a problem across the fence. We kind of grab it and go, oh, let's see. And then we fix it and then we throw it back.
Mm. I saw that on the website you have what you're calling a void methodology or the void methodology. I don't know.
Yeah.
VOAD. Can you tell us a little bit about how it works and where it comes from?
Yeah, VOID stands for Value Oriented Innovation Design. It's a big word. VOID really stands for value. So in order for you to derive value, you need to validate. And so we, again, going back to what I've stated earlier, we design very quickly, we prototype very quickly, and then we validate even quicker. And it's this loop. It's this loop that is so important. And it's this loop that then removes the ego. It removes the, ooh, I have an idea and I'm the boss, right?
Yeah.
It's really about validating in a very educated and evidence-based way. What all the assumptions that you have and all the ideas that you have. So that's where I think that's what drives our process.
Mm.
And then the other thing that drives our process is the fact that, like I was saying, we don't solve problems for people. We solve problems with people.
Yeah.
And by people, I mean large corporations or we have these social, we have these impact trips around the planet where we go into an area, we take a few of our engineers and designers for a month into the outskirts of Nairobi. I say, guys, we're going to camp here. Not literally camp there, but you get the gist. And let's look for problems over here that we can solve, right?
Well,
and we'll do that for free and we'll come back and we'll work on the problem. We'll return and really try to solve problems with that community or with that school or with that borough. So there isn't much of a difference. You know, we do that for a school in Nairobi as easily as we would do it for Google, right?
Yeah.
The process is the same.
Yeah.
It's just the people that you put in it. They will have history. They will have experience. They will have an intuition as, that will cut corners, to an extent. So you don't have to validate everything. There are certain things you already know are not really going to work. But for the most part, it works just the same as it works with a big corporation. Mm.
And do you find sometimes with like large corporations, I know that I'm talking to some of them or hearing that in talks, some of them are having a hard time. Like they want to move to something more iterative and, validation based, like you're talking about. But, you know, the way they organize this through a lot of different silos, a lot of different approval points. Do you find it's a challenge working with it, or is it one of the reasons they like to work with an external partner like you?
Yeah, it is, I think the main reason why they would work with companies like ours, is that they, giants have a hard time dancing.
Yeah.
It's very slow, right? and we operate in pods that we deploy around the planet. We co-locate the clients. We're very, I think, very mobile, very agile. And because we have this startup mentality, we're there to many times disrupt their business,
yeah.
right? It's just that they own that disruption.
Yeah.
And the more comfortable you are and the more market share you are and the more secure you are, the more ripe for disruption.
Yeah.
you know, like, because you're too comfortable.
Yeah.
And
too big, you can get tripped over.
Yeah. And you just don't, we're doing very well. So you're not thinking like a startup anymore. You're not thinking of how to hack it. How can I actually get that little bit of the market? No, you're already too comfortable.
Yeah.
And so having people who have our cultural lifestyle, as suppliers in this case, really, I think we do add a lot of value.
Cool. And I saw also on the website, and you talked about that in your talk you created mornings, that there's a lot of side projects that you're putting out there, different products, different services, prototypes. Are they born out of the kind of trips you were talking about to Africa, or not necessarily, or?
No, we do hackathons,
okay.
In-house hackathons, and the ideas that get validated, they're actually trying to solve problems that we have or others have.
Yeah.
We make them.
Yeah.
All our.
So stuff like the bond bracelet, still something?
The bond bracelet, we now have a Nikabot. Nikabot is our attempt to turn our office manager into a robot.
Okay.
Because a lot of what our office manager does is just pointless, right? Chasing people, asking them what projects there are, so then she can interface with the accounting department. Really, I mean, how boring is that, right? I'd rather pay her to be on holiday. Really, honestly. So what we did was to turn her into an algorithm, into a bot, goes into Slack, and asks people every day what they're up to. You can chat to her and ask what people are up to. That came from a hackathon. It's a need we had because we're so mobile. We're spread around the world. What are people doing? And where are they? And then how do you turn that conversational UI, that conversation into spreadsheets and valuable data that is then going to augment the business intelligence that our financial department gives.
Cool. So are you involved I'm guessing from what you're saying, looking into what's going on in the advancements of artificial intelligence and new algorithms. I'm saying this because I was at a conference at King's College last week with a few people talking about artificial intelligence. Of course, everybody was talking about the win at the Go game, the Google computer one, which is.
I think everybody's talking about AI, I don't think that many people are doing AI.
Yeah.
And when they say they're doing, it's usually just a simple algorithm that has nothing to do with a neural network or an architecture for learning.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think we're working on some stuff that touches AI that I would say is for learning architectures that learn themselves. I don't think we're doing it as much as we would like. And the reason why is because in a lot of instances, it's a solution looking for a problem.
Yeah.
Rather than a problem looking for a solution. So, that I think that's kind of our stand on it. As if you were to ask us about the blockchain and Ethereum.
And what's Ethereum? Ethereum
is this, Ethereum is actually a foundation. It's not a non-for-profit foundation.
Okay.
And it's a platform, that of distributed computing. So decentralized computing.
Okay.
That allows you to create smart contracts, create and distribute currencies, exchanges, on top of it. So it's a distributed technology that's very, that's super safe, very auditable, very open source, and is pushing the blockchain to the next level. If I had to describe it very simply, if you would know what a blockchain is.
Just so for anybody who doesn't know, just so you.
Yeah. So a blockchain is a distributed database.
Yeah.
So yeah, databases, they're quite centralized. The blockchain is a ledger, right? That is completely distributed. And that means, it speaks to what Tim Berners-Lee wanted with the internet in the beginning. The internet's become quite centralized, right? So you have these big giants that own it, right?
Yeah.
When it shouldn't be like that, it should be much more fragmented. It should be much more fragmented, and the blockchain offers that. The blockchain is the first real instance of a completely truly decentralized reality around computing that we have since the early days of HTTP. And the beautiful thing about it is it's really hard to hack. I don't know if it has been hacked, because when you store information, you have a public key and a private key kind of system. And when you store information, it's stored in all of these computers that get paid, with bitcoins for holding the ledger. So it's actually a very simple system theoretically, right? But then you go into cryptography and it becomes rather more complex.
Yeah.
But the decentralization of it, is fundamental. The decentralization also means that you're disintermediating a lot of services. So in terms of financial services right now, it goes through a central database, a central, computer. And that I get taxed for that. I get pay for that when a transaction should cost me almost nothing.
Right.
Literally virtually almost nothing. So with the blockchain and Ethereum and this decentralized reality, this decentralized reality, which is I think it's much more empowering. For entrepreneurs, for example, because suddenly from a legal perspective, they can just create a smart contract and, so they can create a company in 10 seconds. The templates are there. You are a partner. My other friend's a partner. I'm a partner. When dividends come in, they get automatically distributed. So you're gradually disintermediating your reality. I don't need so much legal, advice or lawyers. I don't need so many bankers in between. I don't need so much tax advice. It should all be algorithmic, you know, to save me time.
Yeah.
And that is a reality I find more interesting to work in right now, than AI necessarily. Than the buzzword AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, so we invested in a company called Breveno, who is doing a financial cloud, on top of Ethereum. And there are, I find that part of technology and that future more interesting.
It's very, very interesting. But do you think, because it's moving very fast, and I know that the large banks are investing into, and all the financial services are looking into all these technologies. But you're talking also about eliminating a lot of people and a lot of systems and a lot of companies.
Yeah, you're not going to eliminate.
I mean, eliminate.
Just, you're not going to eliminate banks. People still need
loans. Are some people going to be trying to slow things down because they don't know what the future is going to be?
Or? Well, they're in very comfortable positions, right?
Exactly, right.
They lend money. If you want to transfer something, they charge you an exorbitant amount of money. And whenever things go wrong, we bail them out. I mean, it's a really comfortable position to be in. So do they really want to be disrupted? No. Are they going to be disrupted? Yes. Right. And very, very quickly. And they know that.
Yeah.
So I think a part of them is just resigned to the fact that they will be disrupted, like most big companies. It's just the way it is.
Mm.
And a part of them is saying, oh, could we create our own blockchain? Could we create our own decentralized system and charge for that, right?
Yeah.
And
then the next one is like, how fast or how soon? Because governments are being disrupted as fast, and their policies can't really or aren't catching up fast enough to follow any kind of technologies.
That I would dispute. I don't think governments are being disrupted as fast as they should be.
Okay.
I think what is happening is that because we digitize most of our reality, and it lives on servers, sometimes there's a leak, right? And so, transparency.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how it actually works. And then you got people moving, and hurrying to kind of, what can we do about this? Oh yeah, that's actually very unfair. We should change this. And it's this drive for transparency through, random leaking that is kind of moving things along. on the government side, which is not really planned for, and it's a system reacting to a reality that's a little bit beyond their control. They're not really kind of going, oh, how can we sit down with open democracy from Pia Mancini and Errol and represent, from Edward here in the UK and a whole bunch of other services out there. And really try to figure out how we can start to empower our citizens to help them towards a more direct democracy. At the end of the day, I don't really want politicians. I want to be talking about issues, and I'm an educated man, and so are my peers, and I want to be able to vote for issues. I don't want to be giving you my vote and then you
represent me.
Represent me. And there's two people between us and a very complex system. What I think we need to start doing is going more towards direct democracy. And there's no technical reason why we're not doing that. The reason why we're not doing that is the same reason why banks aren't innovating as fast as they can. It's because they're in power, right?
Yeah.
So it's inertia driving. It's inertia driving, and I think we can do a lot better. I think we can disrupt, and we can hack, and we can break the system, and we can rebuild it in a fair way if it needs to be broken. If it's just a gentle evolution, then it should gently evolve. But something needs to happen around this digital reality that we inhabit, where we feel like tools are being used for the values that we truly believe, which is empowering citizens, small entrepreneurs, companies, with transparency, with the ability to audit things, with speed, which it already does, but speed then again is very glorified. And you know, in some instances, there's a lot of value in having speed, in others, there isn't. You know, we live about 100 years or something. Sometimes we need to take it easy.
Yeah. We mentioned at the beginning of the interview kind of facetiously that you have a daughter pretty recently, so a baby. Did that change your outlook on the future of technology or what you would want for the future to look at things as a father now?
No, not at all.
So what you just described, would that be a good description of your kind of vision for the future at the moment or what you want for it?
I would want less technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think having a cup of tea and just having a conversation is so much nicer than doing this over Skype.
Yeah.
So I definitely would want less technology, but that would mean that technology would have to be much more efficient.
Yeah.
And the processes and the politics and the framework behind it really designed for us. At the end of the day, it's on one planet, right? You throw some micro beads over here and some fish is going to die. And then, so we're all very connected, not to sound too hippie.
Yeah.
that is the reality.
Yeah.
So, my daughter hasn't really had much impact. I mean, her operating system is still kind of, you know, the apps are still installing slowly. So it is, it's a beautiful exercise, and it's very endearing. And I think it teaches you a lot about yourself more so than about the future that you want.
Yeah.
That is for sure. I think spending a week with a 14-year-old has potentially opened up my eyes a little bit more towards the future I want. And that's why I say a bit less technology would be nice.
Mm.
Because, you know, I don't know if you spent some time with a 14-year-old on Snapchat. It's like...
No, I haven't at all, like, actually, but...
It's like an 18-year-old on crack.
Right.
Literally, right? And it's that...
Where was that?
It was over Christmas.
Okay.
My partner's goddaughter.
Right.
And she lives in that moment. She has her own TV channel. It was through Snapchat. She's done an amazing job at creating that space of, you know, for creative communication. She's creating things in the moment and sharing with her mates, and that turns into her communication. There's no history.
Yeah.
There's, I think post 2008, we don't really like history, but you know why. But, but there's very little patience. There's very, her long-term memory is, I don't know, possibly damaged. her short-term memory is inexistent. There is something about her ability to be happy, but you know, if you were to remove all of your titles of, you know, I'm a son and I'm a father and I'm a citizen, what do you get left with? You know, that's just this presence, right? It's just this, all these 1 trillion cells kind of being present here, for a little while. And just to be able to enjoy that, you don't get that with, or that's not facilitated with the type of technology we're creating.
Yeah.
And they're not interested in that. They're interested in hooking you up like a drug.
Right? Yeah.
To an engine where your identity is asserted and defined solely by your interaction and the frequency of that interaction with your tribe, with your group, right? And it's a bit like, you know, the Frankfurter School of Philosophy. Yes, we are very much, our identity is very much created in the space between people, in the interaction.
Yes.
Right? For sure. I give you that. But I think there are more creative ways to interact, with people. And these startups who then eventually become massive corporations because of the appetite and that their audience has for this product that makes their interaction between people much more fun and artificial and crazy and visually rich. I think you end up losing a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see the future, a future for Georgia in this case, my partner's goddaughter, where I'm curious to see how she will cope with technology, and whether technology, you know, what's the next crack hit, you know, that is going to hook her into. At Facebook, you have that feed. And before, we used to have television, right? And then the mobile phone came increasingly closer. Now it's really close to you, to your face, so much so that you're starting to do VR. And we have this constant feed of bite-sized information. Keep it simple. And those are mechanisms for control. That's how you control the masses. And there's a lot of value in it. And, you know, I use Facebook, I use Snapchat. I just like to use a hammer.
Yeah.
I just don't use a hammer all the time.
Yes.
This needs to be seen more as tools and less as distraction.
Yeah. And a way of life and something you're doing all the time. Wow. It's super interesting. Time flies.
Good.
I usually finish my interviews with a couple of what I'm calling the cool down questions. Just, one is, of course, it's the Ice Cream for Everyone, podcast. So there's an ice cream question wedged in there. Do you like ice cream? Do you have a favorite flavor?
I'm vegan. So I like ice cream.
Do you make a coconut based one?
I like coconut based ice cream and sorbets.
Yeah.
For sure. Who doesn't like ice cream?
So that's why it's always an easy question. But I kind of change and mix it around sometimes. Do you have a favorite dish or a favorite food that would be good as an ice cream or go well with ice cream? Or sorbet and or coconut based, of course, right?
A favorite food. Oh man, I used to be such a foodie.
Oh yeah.
And last month I decided to become vegan. For all my sins.
How's that going?
It's going well.
It's okay.
It's going well. I still have a vegan free home. Which is my mother's home, which I go to in order to have, you know, squid ink and all sorts of, delicacies.
Yeah.
But apart from those very, rare moments when I get to spend time with my mom at her place, I'm completely vegan. So, favorite vegan foods. The reality is I still don't have a favorite vegan food.
Yeah, this is brand new.
This is brand new.
Yeah.
I do like the simplicity of raw.
Mm.
It kind of made me reconnect with, you know, just put some corn just cook some corn or some, bake a sweet potato and put some pepper on it. You know, like simple things that I do like. With ice cream, I don't want to completely undermine your.
No, that's fine.
let me just see what would I eat with ice cream. I think passion fruit, like squeeze, like passion fruit with a little bit of ice.
Brilliant. Another interest of mine and also some of the interviews on the podcast is games and gaming and play in general. I was wondering do you happen to play any games? And is it something that you, or methodologies that you explore or use in part of your work or hackathons?
I don't know anyone that doesn't play games. And if they say they don't, they're probably lying. Everybody plays games. We love games. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
So to talk about.
Do you have a favorite game or something that you.
Game. My favorite game would be chess.
Okay.
I do like chess. I never got into Go. By game, I mean, if you really go into the digital world, I think Snake is a masterpiece. And if it's not in Snake.
Oh, Snake, right. Yeah. It is.
And if it's not in the Museum of Modern Art, it should be.
Yeah.
What else? I play most of the games that come out, but I just play them to understand if there's something new. And I don't think I get hooked.
I kind of do the same thing, actually. My background is more in fantasy role-playing games, telling stories, board games that I really, really like. But I really like looking at the mechanics of gaming and the mechanics that are happening there.
I think I share that with you. Yeah. I was just playing this game around firefighting.
Yeah.
And it's this role play game that you need to figure out. You know, you're like, you have this walkie talkie and you run around, I think it's somewhere in California.
Mm.
And you have these watchtowers and you're communicating with somebody and you're making decisions and you're trying to figure out who killed whom and what happened.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. There was something about it that I thought, oh, there's something interesting here. The game has given me a virtual walkie-talkie, right? To talk to an algorithm, right? I thought there was something in it that kind of pushed a little the boundaries for me, but then I'm not the biggest gamer, so I'm sure gamers listening to this would be going, oh, what about this? And what about that?
And lastly, talking about brands and advertising, and it's interesting, you were saying earlier about, you know, the way that we're using technology is sort of manipulating the masses, but at the same time, and I don't know, you tell me how you feel about that, but it's such a system that I don't think anybody, any one person or any one organization or any one brand is doing the manipulating, or at least what do you think the role of brands is in terms of this idea of spending all this time hooked to technology like it's drugs?
So the value of a brand is the difference between the real value of the product and the perceived value, right? So it is very tangible, right? So brands exist because they add value, right? There's an element of imagination. There's a layer of imagination goes on top of a product that suddenly are like, wow, made me think of all sorts of things that brand has invested in putting in my head, and therefore I will give my extra 5 quid to that product, right? That layer is an interesting layer, right? So what do I think of brands? For me, it's really all about what do you stand for? What are your values, right? So if you take a Patagonia, they had this amazing ad, was please don't buy this jacket. You know, it's literally advertising, don't buy this jacket. If you don't need it, don't buy it. That resonated with a lot of people, including myself. We work with Fairphone, for example, on the software side, and it is a brand that has positioned itself as a movement to bring transparency into a process that has so far been extremely opaque. And to change the ways products are made.
Just quickly, for the people who don't know, Fairphone is a
Dutch company whose mission it is to create a phone in the fairest possible way.
So we know where the products are sourced and all the different components.
Different components. There's an ingredient aspect of where those products are sourced, but also a very strong, ingredient/ecological aspect to that. But there's a very strong social aspect to that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether the coltan comes from conflict mines or whether you're paying minimum wage in China. All of these things matter. It's a very complex, complex supply chain. And their mission really is, it could have been a toaster, right?
Yeah.
But it turned out they started with a phone, which is not making their life any easier. But start with the phone they did. And the job is really bringing transparency to that supply chain. So the value of that brand is in the mission, right? By buying this product, you are supporting this mission, right?
Yes.
And I think that's how products and services should be positioned. By buying our services, right, as an agency, you are supporting all of these products and all of these trips solving problems around the world that we actually do, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is the, when you buy a Coca-Cola, what is it that we are, that we are supporting? What, you know, what is, our money is going to change something, right?
Yes.
If it's not, then should you really be, should you really be buying that product, you know? So yeah, so that's, I think brands should really think about that imagination layer and think that that imagination layer needs to be connected to something real that is all about their mission and what they, what impact they really have in this world.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Cool. Oh, to finish off, is there anything about, so Kwame Corp, people can find their website online, kwamecorp.com.
Yeah.
And, is there anything, announcement or anywhere you're speaking soon or anything you want to?
No, I never do these things.
You never do these things.
All right, no, cool. I very seldomly. I did it with, Victoria asked me, but I,
well, I really appreciate your time, even more so.
Very, very seldomly. So yeah, I mean, we, you know where to find us. Just knock on the door and come and have lunch.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Okay, thank you so much for listening. That's already another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you enjoyed, how about sharing it with a friend? As I said at the beginning, another thing that makes a huge difference, I can't state it enough, I know I repeat myself, but it really does make a difference, is if you leave a rating or review on your favorite podcasting app. So if you, you know, you're probably listening to this from a podcasting app, you might be listening from my website, but if ever you're listening from a podcasting app, or if you're on your computer listening to this, just open iTunes if you have it and leave us a review or rating. Just give us stars or thumbs up, whatever it is on your podcasting app. It makes a hell of a difference, allows other people to listen to it, or quite simply, send it to a friend. If you think you know or you know a friend who's interested in design and technology and would enjoy hearing from Kwame or in any of the other episodes, then by all means, send it over. If you have feedback, questions, comments, I'd love to hear from you, of course. You can contact me via email. My email is Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. That's everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. My username on Twitter is at HippoWill. I'm available there. You can tweet at me. You can also find Ice Cream for Everyone on Facebook if that's what you prefer using. So, you know, you can like the page. That helps as well. And that's about it for now. Have a fantastic week. Until next time. Bye-bye.